Hello, this is Ashley. Welcome to the Through Every Season podcast. Everyone is welcome here, and it's a safe space for you to explore your faith in God. We all go through different journeys in life. That includes highs, lows, and everything else in between. Grab a drink of the day, a snack, and take a seat. We'll help you walk through every season. Welcome, Megan, to the Through Every Season podcast. I'm super excited to have you on the podcast. Do you mind giving everybody a little bit of information about yourself?
Sure, Ashley. Well, it's an honor and privilege to be here. So thank you for this opportunity. So yeah, my name is Megan DeVito. I live with my husband and my two teens at the, we live in the Jersey Shore. I love coming alongside Christian women and helping them in all different areas of life, and especially business. So that's my passion.
Like in every single podcast, we do drink of the day around here. So Megan, do you have a drink to share with us today?
I do. I am drinking watered down body, zero sugar Body Armor cherry lime. And I've been enjoying that all day long.
Oh, yes. My husband loves Body Armors. He really likes those. And it's really hot here in the Midwest. Like, it's above like national average temps. So when we're recording this, it is the 18th of June. It is, at least in Ohio, like almost 100 degrees. But what's it like by you?
So we're in, my husband just said it's 88 degrees and it's in the evening. So it was a hot day today, but the humidity isn't bad. So I could tolerate it.
Gosh, humidity was terrible here the past few days. And it's like this all week. So yeah, electrolytes and the body armor, probably needed one of those today.
Yes.
It's so hot. My drink of the day is a bubbly sparkling water. It's the cherry bubbly. It actually tastes a little bit like cherry Coke. So if you like cherry Coke, you may like that drink. I will say I don't have a poppy today or an Olipop. I had to go to my local gas station and I was a little limited for drink of the day today. I thought about making a mocktail. It didn't quite happen today, especially after sitting in rush hour traffic.
So sparkly drink of the day convenience. That's what it is. Yes.
Here we go. It was like the only thing that they had at the gas station that was, you know, a sparkly, bubbly drink. So today's topic, we have a few different topics all in one today. That includes addiction recovery, establishing boundaries, which on the Through Every Season podcast, we've talked about boundaries and boundaries within the Christian faith too. So we love that around here, as well as going in contact with family and loved ones, which we have not talked about on the podcast. And I think so many people will be interested in hearing about that today. So we're just going to dive right in. So on the Through Every Season podcast, often with guests, we go back to the beginning or we start in childhood just to get a glimpse of who was Megan when you were a kiddo? What was your surroundings like? What was your environment like? How have you changed from child to adult or where you are now? And then all the meat and potatoes in between. So you had previously shared that your family is a huge part of your story. Of course, we want to provide a safe and a trauma-informed space here on the Through Every Season podcast. We do talk a lot about childhood experiences, and sometimes that does include childhood trauma too, or some really heavy topics within childhood. So what was your childhood like? And what was it like being a part of the family that you grew up with?
So Ashley, I go back to a certain age. I go back to 15 because that's when I started actively drinking and become an active alcoholic. Growing up, I thought we were normal. I grew up in rural Pennsylvania. I grew up in the country and it was, going to the lake and the pools in the summer, sports, getting healthy. I realized how unhealthy my growing up was. Looking back at it, I really start back at 15. There's a lot of my childhood. I don't know. It wasn't that there was trauma in my childhood. There was functional dysfunction, but I don't remember a lot of my childhood. And so, but I remember my adolescence and my early teens, especially starting at 15.
That's so interesting that you bring up that a lot of your memories from your childhood, you don't exactly have the best memory of before you were 15. We love to talk about the brain here sometimes, or at least I do. I don't know if everybody else likes hearing about it. Definitely likes to protect ourselves. And when you're growing up in such a chaotic environment, sometimes even without realizing, we definitely go into flight or fright. What were you like as a child? What was school like for you growing up?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I grew up as a twin. So I did have a twin. I'm a fraternal twin. So a lot of my identity was in my twin, unfortunately. And I didn't see that. And also too, Ashley, just because I'm non-contact, doesn't mean I'm a victim. You know, everyone did the best that they could with what they had, right? So I just want to put that disclaimer in. But growing up, childhood, I was active in sports, but it was like really like the identity of my twin, what he wanted, you know, personality where he was catered to from my parents, which was fine, but that led into his addiction as well. Both were very addicted to different substances, one where I got healthy, one he didn't. But throughout the school year, let's say school ages, I loved high school. I loved going to football games. I loved partying. It was a big party place for me. I loved being social. I knew I had something in me though, where I always loved business and I loved entrepreneurship and I loved working. And I, at an early age, especially I remember at 15, working in the restaurant industry, making my own money and really putting my identity in that, you know? So I was driven by success. And I know that was part of the addiction as well.
Did you have a bond with your brother or with your twin? What was that bond like, if you had one?
That's all I knew, right? So the way I grew up in a Irish Catholic family. It was like whatever happens here stays here. That was the theme, right? So it was like whatever dysfunction happened in the house, like we just never went and like sought help for it, right? My twin and I, we were very close, but I was the caretaker, and I became the caretaker not only for him emotionally, but also for a healthy mother and a father. So they had their own marital issues, and I now see that I became the sounding board or the emotional support for two adults and a twin. So that's what really I think drove me to drinking at an early age.
That's a lot for an adolescent to handle, not just having like a peer or somebody your age that relies on you for emotional support. Because a lot of times when we're teens, we rely on our peers for a lot of our emotional support and even our emotional development. But with two adults, that as a child shouldn't be your responsibility. And that's a huge role to take on within a family.
I remember like when I was in high school, I wanted to go away to college, but no one wanted me to, right? And it was like, I'm gonna go ahead. Like, I just wanted to fly, you know? I thought it was protection, but it was also that it was kind of like the glue, right? Like, that kept the thing, you know, the family together. And it's like a baby mobile, right? Like, everyone's on the baby mobile having a good time. And then when someone gets off, the baby mobile gets unbalanced, it gets wonky, right?
So you had mentioned that you grew up within an Irish Catholic home. What was that like? Did you feel that that prepped you for a relationship with God, or do you feel that it was very structured and legalistic? What was that experience like for you as a child, and as well for your family too?
The reason why I bring up that I grew up in an Irish Catholic home is because when I grew up, like our Irish culture was everything. It drove us. Like it was like, we're Irish, so we're going to go party. Like it was just like, we're Irish and people drank and they had a drinking problem. It's because we're Irish, right? And I hate to say that. It sounds terrible, but that's the way I grew up. But it was that my parents, the way that they grew up with alcoholics as parents and they never healed. So here are two broken people now raising two children, right, in this Irish Catholic family who never took care of their own brokenness of their alcoholic family, right? So it was just all these generational cycles that just kept coming over. It was like a tidal wave, right, of generation after generation. So what my relationship with the Lord was that I always believed in God. I remember if I didn't remember, like memorize my prayers, I was in trouble. And I remember getting like pinched on the arm if because I had a, you know, test out on CCD. And so I always was afraid of God, that I wasn't the best student studier. So I felt as if I didn't know how to pray and recite those prayers, then I wasn't worthy. And I could tell you, Ashley, I didn't hold a Bible in my hand until I was in my 30s. I was taught it was that if you didn't do these, these services or these acts, then it was sacramental. Like you just didn't move forward, or so it was just a lot of guilt. I grew up very, very guilty. I was always sorry for something. And I just always had that ache in my heart that I always felt bad, and that's why I think one of the reasons why at an early age I just numbed it with alcohol.
My husband calls it Catholic guilt. So
Yes.
good old Catholic guilt. If my
Yes.
mother-in-law is listening to this, I promise we love you.
Oh, I mean, some of the best people in my circle now, they're practicing Catholics, but they have a relationship. I was just never taught in our household to have a relationship.
I know we talked a little bit about this, at least within your family, but did you experience any trauma during your adolescence, whether that was within peers, within your personal life, or within family?
I mean, I was a blackout drunk, I was a blackout drinker. So there was trauma every Friday, Saturday night, I mean, then waking up instantly, alcohol and my brain chemistry just did not mix at an early age. But alcohol was condoned in our house. It was allowed. So I was allowed to go drink, but I would get blackout drunk, but then I would get in trouble or I would get beat. Right. And then what would happen would be that I would trigger my father because his mother was a blackout drunk alcoholic. So he would take out his frustrations and anger on me. Instead of, as a parent, seeing that your child needs help and providing support, or maybe not, not giving them alcohol, buying the alcohol, or even just getting support, it was this vicious cycle of, getting in trouble. I mean, I blacked out drunk so hard right before a football game in high school. And my father dragged me out by my hair, and I got beat, and I had to go to school that Monday morning, like when my face messed up, and I was told to make the lie that I was taking cold medicine, right? So like I always had to cover up for the addiction that I had, but it was condoned. So it was so crazy, right? I mean, it's as a parent now, I look back and I'm like, it's just like mind blowing, right? That dynamic, but that's how we operated.
Oh, wow. And it's unfortunate too that though you needed help, you were also met with aggression, which also doesn't do well for brain chemistry either. When you do something and then in retaliation, instead of being met with love, you're met with aggression.
Yeah. It was a really vicious cycle,
Generational sin definitely is within families. It's like a generational curse or generational trauma. It's something that's passed along from generation to generation, and it's like a cycle again, like what you said, it's a cycle that you can't break. Or there seems like it's a cycle that you can't break. So I think that that's another theme too that we're talking about today is, of course, every single family has their issues. Every single family has had some type of sin that has been passed along from generation to generation. We see it in the Bible, even being talked about in different stories. But yeah, just a great topic to talk about because I'm sure a lot of people will be able to relate to that in some capacity. Getting more into your addiction, of course, and then we'll get into your recovery story too. You shared, of course, recovery is a huge part of who you are. It's a huge part of your story, and it should be because going through recovery is amazing, and we love that around here. And you've shared that you have been in long-term recovery for 20 years. That's amazing, like absolutely incredible. We love talking about recovery over here. Everybody knows that. When did substances or alcohol use come into your life? You said it was when you were 15. Is that correct?
Yeah, vividly. I had my first beer at 15. Felt that, the warmth, the buzz right to my head, and then I was off to the races. And it was allowed, like I said. It was condoned. I remember at 17, my father got me a keg for my birthday. So it was just I was drinking buddies with my family, with my parents, so.
Wow. That definitely was not was not my parents. I had very strict parents. But there are teenagers out there, and even teenagers that I grew up with, where they also drinking was condoned in their house, or even said, "Well, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it here." So that was something that I had heard as a child too. Just different family dynamics and different issues and different problems. 100%. How did substance use or alcohol, since alcohol was your substance of choice at this point in your life, how did it affect your life during that time period?
Well, it was all I knew. So it's like, it's what I went to for everything, right? So I went to it when I was happy, I went to it when I was sad, I was celebratory, but that's how my parents operated as well. It was always, I mean, I remember one of our friends in high school tragically killed in a car accident before the week where, we're at the bar, then we're after the bar. And it was like, it just alcohol, like, controlled every aspect of our life. Even to the fact where, like, I loved the restaurant business and the bar industry because I knew after I would be able to drink off of, underage drink. When I was 17, I had the privilege of being able to go to Ireland with a group of students and for 5 weeks and got on a plane. And my first question on the plane talking to people were like, "Do you think we're gonna be able to drink?" Like, it just consumed me, right? So but the thing is, Ashley, I thought I was wired so hard that I thought if you didn't drink, you were the one with the problem. Like, I didn't want to be associated with anyone that didn't drink.
And you had said, of course, that alcohol was your substance of choice at this time. Did you experiment with alcohol or any other substances?
Yes, I did. There was other just like casual drug, like drugs, but nothing like no needles or anything like that. But there
Okay.
was cocaine involved, yeah.
I went to a conference a couple weeks ago. It was the largest addiction conference in Ohio, and I went to a breakout session, and they were talking about trends that they were seeing at their treatment facility in Cleveland, Ohio. And they said that they were seeing something that was really, really interesting, and I've kind of seen with my clients too, is that it used to be, for the most part, that if people drank, they were drinkers. If people used other substances like meth, we're just going to use meth as an example. That was kind of what they did, but they didn't really touch alcohol. But nowadays, they're seeing everything's kind of intertwining. There's no that ever somebody's class A and somebody's class B, and this is what I am and this is what I do. Everybody's kind of experimenting and using everything.
And we'll get into the recovery, but what brought me into rehab was Xanax.
Oh,
Like, that's
wow.
what brought me in because I was trying to get off the alcohol, right? So it was just like chasing one thing after another, even though they were prescribed and I thought, they were prescribed, like I was abusing them, right? So, but it was like, but I did have a fear. Like, I did have a healthy fear that I didn't want to get to, like, I didn't want to go to other drugs. Like, I just was like scared of it. But I have to say, like, I truly loved alcohol. Like, I loved it. So it was just like, I didn't really care about anything else because I loved to drink. I loved it, like, so that was my drug of choice. Yeah.
Oh, I think alcohol is the most scary of them all, and it's legal
Yeah.
for anybody over the age of 21. And that's what is absolutely terrifying, but by far, I think it's the worst one out there. It's the worst one to detox off of. Most dangerous to detox off of is alcohol. So it's hard. It's hard to recover from. What was your faith like during your active use?
Like, I knew there was God, there was a God, and I know there's Jesus, but I had a fear of God because I was guilty all the time. I was in full sin all the time, right? So my faith was there, but I would say my prayers were recited. It's what I learned. And then they were foxhole prayers. God, if you get me out of this, I'm never going to do this again, right? They were just foxhole prayers. But that was my faith. So it wasn't really until I surrendered everything and like just really put boundaries in place and started healing where then I could have that intimate relationship with the Lord.
How long were you in active use until you found recovery?
10 years. I got sober when I was 25. And so my 20th anniversary would be this August. It would be 20 years this August.
Amazing that you found recovery so early in your life, too.
Yeah, I mean, I know I'm just so grateful, and I know what you do professionally now, and but it's those moms who are trying to get sober. Like, those are my heroes, because when I got sober, it was just me. Like, I didn't have children, I didn't have a spouse. Like, I was able to be so selfish in my recovery that but I God knew that that's what I needed, but I was able to really take care of myself because I didn't have littles to take care of, you know. Yeah, but it's that yeah, I am grateful that I found it at an early age. And it was hard because, and we'll get into that story, but it was hard really surrendering to it, because I never thought there was a life after alcohol.
So you enter recovery, you're 25-year-old Megan. What does the start of your recovery look like at this point in time?
So I had a very successful corporate career at an early age, and my fear was if I got help, I would lose my job. But I'm like driving drunk and blackouts, right? So like that wasn't making me afraid to lose my job, right? But like going away and getting help, that's what scared me, right? So I was afraid of being found out, because I had my work personality where I was all put together and career focused, and then, you know, after hours, all bets were off. So, but then what happened was I put the alcohol down. I woke up in a blackout in the streets of Philadelphia in a car, in my car. And I was in a parking lot, and there was a trucker, a truck, like a big 18-wheeler in the parking lot of this Kmart that was closed. And the trucker tried to get me in his cab. And I remember I came to at this point, and he was trying to lure me into his cab. And I knew, like, I can't go in this cab because I'm not going to come out, you know? And he said, if you don't come in this cab, I'm going to call the police. So I had my keys in the ignition, and I called somebody at that time. And I said to him, I'm in trouble. Like, I don't know what to do. He said, take the keys out of the ignition. So the cops came, and I did have something on my front seat of the car that I purchased in my blackout that I'm not proud to say, but it was there. The cops shone their flashlights in the car, took me out, drove me home. That was it. And then I got dropped off at my apartment. I went to a neighbor that I didn't know, and I said, listen, my car is down at the Kmart, and I have stuff in there, and if you take me in my car, I'll share it with you. So we went down, got my car, finished what was in the car, and then the next morning I woke up, put a business suit on to go to work, and I said, I can't do this anymore. I need help. And the only thing I knew to do was call my mom at that time. And I went to my first AA meeting, sweating bullets.
I think that the AA community, or Alcoholics Anonymous, is such an incredible community. The AA and NA community they're just incredible. So entering into your first AA meeting, you said you were sweating bullets. How did that first meeting go?
I left. I walked out because I'm like, you know, I'm not like these people. And it was a daytime meeting. If you're familiar with AA, it was like a clubhouse type of meeting. So they were the reg it was just a it was just a meeting that a lot of older people, gentlemen there, you know, I just didn't feel like it was for me, so I left. And then I had insurance. I had a great job, so I started seeking professional help and what that looked like. And I found counseling right around the corner from my apartment. There was a counseling center there, and I knew it. The sign was there. I actually called it a year prior, and I never went for my appointment. I canceled it, and I went and I got help from a counselor, and he advised me to go into IOP, intensive outpatient. So I started with IOP, and I'm in a small group getting help, educating myself on the alcohol, what's going on. But in the meantime, I was eating Xanax because of the anxiety. And I then in the IOP session, I was honest with them what I was doing, and they said, you need help, you need to go inpatient. So then I went inpatient.
And what was your inpatient experience like?
My inpatient, let me just paint the picture for you how sick I was when I got there. People were leaving against medical advice. You know, they were leaving,
That
and
was
I'm
you.
handing out Xanax to them as they're leaving because I felt bad for them.
I guess, you know, empathy. We love that around here.
Right? You know, I was compassionate. I am, you know, I a people pleaser, recovering in that as well. So I walked into inpatient in a blackout because I was like, if we're going down, I'm going down. And I took probably 15 Xanax at one time. went in a blackout. I was honest with them. I said I thought they were going to dispense my Xanax to me. I honestly thought I was going into like a spa treatment. Like I had no idea. Like I just packed pajamas. Like I didn't even pack like clothes. And the nurse that was doing my intake, I gave her the Xanax and I was like, here, because I thought she was dispensing. And she went to go, she turned around, she said she was going to pour them down the toilet. And I grabbed five more and ate five more. So I was in a really sick blackout when I went in. And my first roommate there, we're friends to this day, and she's celebrating her 20 years. And she was older than I was, and she just took me under her wing, and she loved on me. And I was there for a short amount of time, Ashley. I was there for maybe a week, and then my insurance told me that I couldn't stay any longer.
You should be cured by now. What the heck?
Yep, right. So here I am, right, packing my bags out and going back to the real world.
Did you follow up with going to AA and enjoying that community or restarting your IOP program? What did recovery look like for you after you left inpatient?
So yeah, I went back. My seat was still there in IOP. They were waiting for me. So I went back to IOP, and then I kept searching the right meetings for myself. At that time, I was 25. So here I am. All my friends, they were people, places, and things. I couldn't associate with them for my health. So I found a meeting that was a Thursday night meeting, and it was like a party. And I'm telling you, it was like a rally. Like there were so many young kids there, young people. It was loud. It was my energy. Like I just loved it. And I just kept going back to that meeting. And then I would go to the Sunday meetings, and then I would go to Saturday morning meetings. And then I just started going to meetings, and it was every day for me because that's what I needed.
That's great. That's beautiful. And when you were in the AA meetings, did people bring their kids if they had kids?
I don't remember that. I was probably, yeah, because I wasn't a mom at the time, I probably didn't pay attention to that. I don't remember that, no. I remember I was in one AA meeting once, and there was an early adolescence teen. I went to welcome the person, and the mom said, "He messed up, and I'm showing him what this is like." And I was like, "Oh, wow." She was showing him what a room of alcoholics looked like because she didn't want him to get there. I remember that.
That's some interesting. I don't even think that that's immersion therapy, but that's something.
That's a concept. That's a concept, right? Yes. How about that? Yes. So, yeah, but AA was it was a really big part of my early couple years of sobriety. Those people became my family because that's when I started, having to kind of disconnect from my family that I grew up with, but they loved me where I was at, so.
That's beautiful. Again, we love AA around here. We love NA. We love those communities. How did recovery change your life?
I came to the Lord in recovery, so that changed my life. I met my husband in recovery. I was blessed with two children in recovery. So recovery is a foundation that God has called me to have, so I can live the life that He's given me and steward. And we all have a calling, I believe, and we're here for the kingdom. And so now I'm on mission. So it's the foundation of everything that He wants for me. So.
And I love the story that you told about the night that you were met with the semi and the semi driver, because that was complete God's
Oh,
protection
absolutely.
for you. Because who would have known what would have happened had you been able to be lured into his truck? That it's terrifying.
Even I don't even remember how my car even got into that parking lot, and so I mean, so God was, and that's the thing, like seeing His grace and His provision throughout all those years, makes me just so grateful.
Aw, kind of getting into the boundaries segment of the podcast. Oftentimes, when people start their recovery journey, they have to establish boundaries of some sort. Sometimes you can't hang around your friends that you used to because all of your friends still drink and you're deciding at that point in time, I'm no longer drinking, or maybe all of your friends party and use drugs and you're like, well, I can't go to the parties anymore because there's going to be drugs there. There's so many different boundaries. Sometimes people got to move across town because I can't be on this side of town no more, because all it does is remind me of my use, and all it does is remind me of my addiction. I've heard that as well with some people that I know. What were some of the boundaries you set after starting your recovery journey?
There was boundaries in place where, I had my own apartment. So at the time my mother would come and visit and she would bring her own alcohol, and she would hide it, and it was like that just I didn't want it in my apartment, And but that those were boundaries, like early boundaries that were put in place, but also access to me. I was learning how to put boundaries up around my personal space and my emotions, because for so long everyone had just full access to me. And I couldn't take care of myself because I was so worried about what other people were going through or who needed what or the emotional support. So that's really the early stages of the boundaries. And then when I met my husband, that's when the boundaries really came into place.
What was the hardest part about setting boundaries?
For me, feeling, well, in the early stages, now boundaries to me is just like, it's like a muscle memory, right? It's like that heavy lifting that we do at the gym and we're comfortable doing. But in the early stages, when I knew I needed to put boundaries in place to protect my mental health and my physical health, it was the guilt, right? It was like compromising. It was like, well, and not being clear on my boundaries and letting those other, the boundaries down. But then when I had to put boundaries in place, it was, God is so good because He put somebody in my life, my husband in my life. And if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have really, truly, Ashley, have put boundaries in place, because it wasn't about me anymore. It was about someone else that I loved. Because, like, with me, it was just like, whatever, I'll just deal with it, But then when I met my husband, I had to, because I didn't want to lose him.
Do you feel that other people respected the boundaries that you put in place?
Well, when it comes to family, no. So absolutely not. No, they couldn't understand. They didn't have boundaries. And it's like a toddler beginning to walk, right? If a toddler is going to the hot stove, they're going to go to the hot stove because they don't know that there's boundaries in place, right? They're just going to keep doing it. Well, same with people who've never had boundaries. Like, boundaries are not just, we're not born with boundaries. And if we don't build them throughout our childhood, adolescence, like, we don't have them. So people that don't have boundaries don't understand boundaries. People that don't respect boundaries don't respect their own boundaries, right? So yes, it was a very, I would say it was a very difficult time, especially when I got pregnant with my son. It was just a really, and I was in recovery and I was, sober. I met my husband and we started our family, and that's really when I had to put boundaries in place, because I was protecting now my child that was inside me.
So you had mentioned that you have gone no contact with your family 18 years ago. Was it 18 years ago?
Yeah.
So 2 years kind of after your recovery journey had began. What led you to that decision?
It was that I started becoming healthy. I met my husband. We were happy. We were starting a life together, and then there was people on the other side, parents and a twin, and they couldn't accept it. There was just a lot of, they were still in their addictions, right? So they couldn't understand why I wasn't around as much, or and then I became pregnant with our son, and there was just a lot of lashing out and ugliness from them, where we had to get protection from the police involved, and just really angry ugliness, and it was just them lashing out. And so I had to make a decision, and the last decision was the final breaker was I was on a phone call with my mom. My son was born premature, and it was because of stress that I was going through with my family. He was born 32 weeks, so we had a preemie, and he had a lot of complications when he was born. And a couple months after he was born, my mother called and she said, "I want to come see your son." She called him by his first name. "I want to come see it." And I said, "Well, mom, things have to be good between us before you come and see him." And she said, "Well, I got an attorney and I'm taking it to court for grandparent rights." And that was the last time I spoke with her.
Good for you standing ground, because That's really hard to do. One, as an individual, but two, it can be hard as a parent to stand your ground, especially with people close to us, like our own parents. But really important as a parent to be a good example also for your children and standing your ground and having your boundaries. That's really awesome that you were able to, in that moment, stand true to what you want and what you needed. And I think that that is great. What has been the hardest part of going no contact with your family?
I have to honestly say, Ashley, well, the hardest part I think is just the fact that my kids don't know what I looked like when I was little. Like I have no pictures. I don't have a high school yearbook because everything was at my parents' house, right? Like I have no history for my children. And that to me is like the hardest part, right? Because my kids just know me now, but I would love to share with them, what I looked like when I was little. I have one baby picture, But I have so much acceptance in my heart that even Father's Day, I'm praying and I said, Lord, I said, if it doesn't happen now, I said, I'll get to hug my father in heaven, hopefully. I mean, acceptance that we just cannot live in the same world right now together. But I have to say this, it was hard in the beginning when I was an early young parent. But now I have to honestly say, Ashley, my children don't know. They don't know dysfunction. We all have our problems, right? Like we have our arguments, right? And parenting teens is not easy. I lose my patience, but they don't know what true dysfunction looks like. So I can't say all that over it outweighs anything that was hard.
That's such a good point that you brought up about the photos or the other things from your childhood that you just don't have access to. And people might not think about that now because we have cell phones and this thing called iCloud that stores things, I guess, for an infinite period of time. I guess that's how that works. But when you just have photos, physical photos of things, you can't make copies of that without having the original, you know? So that's a very good point to make that it feels like part of your history is just still with your parents and your kids don't get to see that. I also love that you brought up too that, you pray for your dad, like you pray for your families. 'Cause I think sometimes people think like going no contact is holding on to this internal anger and being in hatred. But sometimes it's simply just redefining the relationship and deciding that I'm going to love this person from afar. It does not mean that I hate them. I love them, but I have to love them from afar.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I don't, and that's the thing, like there's no, like my kids don't know bad of my family. They just know that they're not good for my family. They know they're not good people for me. Right. Like, so it's just that, yeah. And now, my son, my kids are teenagers and, I had a lot of fear about them being contacted, but it's, I know that God loves my children more than I do.
That's right. That's a beautiful, beautiful point to make. Do you ever feel judged by other Christians for going no contact with your family?
That's a good question. I don't feel like I'm judged, but also I don't tell my story enough. Right. And I believe that God has called me out to that last year. So I did start a YouTube series, and it was called In Our Mess, God Is Never Confused, and talking about the messy situations Christians go through that we're not talking about in the auditorium or the cafe on a Sunday. So I don't feel that it's judged. I feel like there's a lot of people that need to know how to get through it because what the Bible says, I understand what the Bible says, but sometimes we need people to just roll up our sleeves and get down with us and say, how does this happen? What does it look like? So I don't feel judged. I feel like people need to know.
I think that that's great. There definitely is culture within Christianity that people think that they have to be doormats because, well, you're a
Right.
Christian, you're supposed to love everyone. You're not supposed to judge anyone because you're a Christian. But that doesn't mean that we have to be doormats. We are actually called to set up boundaries.
Yeah,
God
absolutely.
calls us to do that.
Yep. And when I look at boundaries, I look at to the Lord, and he's a prime example of boundaries. And he knows, he's clear who he's going to let in his house and who's not, right? And he's clear of what hates, he'll say it, right? What he hates and what he loves, right? So, and when it comes to also, I'm very selective who's in my circle, Ashley, but like I am there to come alongside people who don't know the Lord. But I also want to be around people who do love Jesus. And unfortunately, my family, at that point did not, and I was called to minister to them. Yes, but I want people that love him and that honor him as well.
In your own words, what does it mean to redefine relationships from a Christian standpoint?
I think look into Jesus and the type of relationships that he has had and people that wanted to know him for his heart and know him was open arms, right? And when he saw people made a change, he was right there beside them as they walked that change. So I think with relationships that if people don't change, it's just like the definition of insanity that we all know. But if people don't change, I always say we have to remove to protect our love for them. And as Christians, I hold people to a high standard of accountability. I just do. And if people aren't doing the work, even if it's small work, right? Just to get better each day, like recovery. You and I right now, Ashley, are sober. We're sober, but recovery is a state, right? It's not a state, it's a process. I'm sorry, sobriety is a state. So every day, even in my recovery is with the Lord. And I just want to be better every day. I want my kids to be better every day. I look to my husband. I want him to grow every day. I have expectations that I need to grow every day. So if I have those expectations because I want to get closer to the Lord, then I want that for my circle and my relationship as well. So if my circle and relationships don't have that, then I'm sorry, then my focus and attention needs to go somewhere else.
I have loved ones that they've had really difficult relationships with their family members, including really, really close family members. And they've had to redefine their relationship, not even necessarily go no contact, but very, very minimal contact. Like if an emergency happens in the family, then you contact them. But as far as like a rapport in a relationship, there has been none. And something that some of those people have struggled with is that guilt. Did you feel any guilt when you went no contact with your family, or do you have any guilt that you feel now?
In the early stages, of course, because that's all I knew is guilt, but now I see it as God's protection.
What advice do you have for people in a similar situation that you were in, where you had to make the decision to go no contact for your protection?
Yeah, outsource, like get people to help you. Like you cannot do this alone. You need professional help. I mean, not only did I have support of other people who also had to go non-contact. If you're in the rooms of AA, if you're in a recovery process or a 12-step program, you'll see that a lot of people similar. A lot of people have to, they have relationship, right? That are broken. But then I had to go and get help from a therapist and really do the work on clearing out how my brain was wired, always to what happens in this house stays in this house, right? Not to air the dirty laundry, right? So I was programmed in such a way for so many years to put my family first no matter what. Now I'm trying to put myself first and the guilt. So it really is, if someone needs to go no contact, please just get some help and support.
Do you feel it is common for Christians to struggle with boundaries?
I do. I see it. I see it because I feel like they're a little, it's a little murky, when it comes to boundaries. I mean, even in my recovery, I got addicted to work and providing, right? So my boundaries, so it wasn't just a boundary issue with the family, and then it went into other things. So I think it in all different areas of life. I mean, we could even get into overcommitting ourselves and serving, right? There's boundaries. Look at the church. Look at the members of the church. A lot of them are available 24/7. So I think a lot of people feel like with their servant hearts, I think they do overextend their boundaries. Yes.
I think that's a huge problem that many individuals within the Christian faith have, is setting those boundaries and knowing your limits and knowing your limitations, especially those that do have a servant's heart, because that overexertion comes from a good place.
It does. It does. However, it can, then the resentments start starting, even if we know it or not, right? We're like little toddlers in our heart, right? Like having tantrums because it's like we're overcommitted, we're burned out, and we're not putting rest first. Maybe our alignment's off, right? We're, so absolutely, but it does come from a good place. Yes.
You have come a long way. You've been through a lot in your life. What does life look like for you right now?
Oh gosh, it's so peaceful. I have my best friend is my husband. We're raising, teens. I have a son that's going into his senior year, and my daughter's going into her junior year. And just walking with the Lord each day, and it's so peaceful. There is just peace, and we have our own stuff, right? Believe me, we do. But I know that I know walking with the Lord is fulfilling.
And you have a coaching business called Consumed Coaching. Can you tell us about your coaching business and the different programs that you offer?
Thank you. So, Consume Coaching, it's Consumed by the Call Coaching. Well, Consume Coaching, Consumed by the Call. That's how it started. And we do have my mentor and CEO, Francine Ivy, runs our Consume Coaching. I am a team lead and an elite coach for Consumed. And what I do, business owners, entrepreneurs, coaches, leaders, align significance with success without compromising their walk with Christ. So, we offer one-on-one coaching, we offer group coaching for entrepreneurs, and then also, I offer a certification. So if someone's looking to become a certified Christian coach, we're able to come alongside them as well.
And if somebody wants to work with you, how can they go about finding you and signing up for your services?
Thank you. Well, the best bet, if you could go to LinkedIn, I'm on LinkedIn, Megan DeVito. You could go to consumedstrategycall.com and fill out a form. I'll be happy to come alongside you there and give you a free strategy call, or you can go onto Facebook or Instagram. Mostly I'm on Facebook. You could always find me there as well. Megan DeVito, Megan with an H.
And you also have a YouTube channel, which you have already alluded to. Can you talk more about your YouTube channel and like the different content that you guys put out?
Yeah, so I have a couple playlists under Consumed Coaching. The one series in our Mascot is Never Confused is talking with Christians, having those hard conversations about their messy seasons of life and how God was never confused in that. So it's really testimonial type of stories. And then the other playlist that I have is for the Kingdom employee, and we are talking with that person that is called to their career. How are they bringing this secular and the sacred together, and they're not separate? So where God has called you, and how are you making a bold impact?
That's incredibly interesting because I haven't heard of anything like that, at least me personally, online. So I think that's awesome. It's a
Thank
very good
you.
niche, very
Thank
good
you.
niche. And we are already know that you've listed the different places that people can find you. And I will make sure that I list everywhere that people can find you, all the things that you're doing in the description of the podcast, but also on the social media post too. So people will have all of those links there. But again, Megan, I just want to thank you for coming on, being vulnerable, and sharing your story. And I hope this was a great experience for you and that you keep on sharing your story because it deserves to be heard.
Ashley, I just want to thank you, and thank you for giving women a platform to give hope to other people. And I encourage you, I'm not, it's not about business for me. If you want to get in my inbox and we could pray together, or you want to share a testimony and I could pray for you, my inbox will be always open. So however I could come alongside you as well. So thank you.
Aw, as everyone knows, the way that we close out here is you're welcome to explore your faith here. Jesus always welcomes you home, and so do I, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for tuning in to the Through Every Season podcast. You can find new episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts on the second and fourth Friday each month. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook using the links in the podcast description. Do you want to come and tell your story or testimony? Fill out the drop form listed in the podcast description. We'll see you next time.